Talk Show.
Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review at Juranov. Welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we bring together national speakers to talk about critical issues in electronic discovery and records management at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and at a time when people are interested in the topic, regardless of where they're located. Today, we're talking again about search and retrieval strategies, which is a very hot topic out there right now, and some of the differences between different litigation support search engines. Our panelists are outstanding. We have Adam Cohen from FTI and Michael McGuire, an attorney at Littler Mendelson. Adam Cohen is a senior managing director in the New York office of FTI's e-discovery compliance consulting practice. He's a nationally recognized expert in electronic discovery and electronic information management policy issues. He advises on planning and implementation issues associated with every phase of electronic discovery and litigations and investigations, as well as electronic information management policies and practices, including, for example, proactive litigation readiness and regulatory compliance, complying with electronic preservation obligations and avoiding spoliation sanctions, crafting and responding to discovery requests, targeting electronic information and cost containment strategies. Prior to joining FTI, Mr. Cohen was a litigation partner at Weil, Gottschall & Manges, where he represented major corporate clients in complex litigation involving computer and internet issues. He's also co-author of the treatise Electronic Discovery, Law and Practice. His latest book is ESI Handbook Sources, Technology and Processes, which provides a comprehensive guide to electronic discovery for non-technical practitioners such as judges, lawyers, corporate executives, and others. Mr. Cohen is also co-chair of the Electronic Discovery Committee of the New York State Bar Association's Federal and Commercial Litigation Section, and a member of the advisory board of the Georgetown Law Center eDiscovery Institute. The other guest here is Michael McGuire, who is a shareholder and member of Littler Mendelson's eDiscovery Group. Michael advises the firm's lawyers and their clients on electronic discovery issues, including preservation, collection, review, and production of electronically stored information. Prior to joining Littler, Michael was the managing director of legal operations for the mortgage division of GMAC, and while at GMAC, he led a cross-function team that preserves, collects, processes, and searches electronically stored information litigation. Before joining GMAC, he was a partner in the litigation and corporate departments at the Minneapolis law firm of Ryder Bennett. While at Ryder Bennett, Mike's practice focused on legal issues arising from the intersection of technology and law, including e-discovery, privacy, and internet issues. He has a number of publications, and he's a frequent speaker on technology and e-discovery issues. Both of you, thank you for joining the show. Okay. Well, the reason this topic is interesting to me is this is a space I work in professionally, and that's sort of nice when you get to talk about things you know about. But I think it should also be very interesting to our listeners because the legal profession is really starting to take notice of this area. Several months ago, the Sedona Conference issued its commentary on achieving quality in the e-discovery process, which highlights the need for more quality in finding ESI and searching for and reviewing ESI in e-discovery matters. There have been recent decisions by Judges Facciola, Grimm, and Peck taking lawyers to task for not having a better handle on how they search for ESI. Craig Ball and Ralph Losey have been blogging about lawyers not understanding enough about how to use technology. So I think it's a hot topic. So why don't we get started? And first question always is, how did you get interested in electronic discovery? Michael, why don't you start first, and then Adam, your experience, how you got involved.
Sure. Well, as you described when you were talking about my background, I've been focusing on the intersection of law and technology for most of my career. And I, like most lawyers who get into e-discovery, I got into it because someone had a problem involving technology in litigation, and they reached out to somebody who they knew could actually take a computer apart and put it back together again. So that was in the mid-90s when I was a litigator, really got interested in the subject. Did a lot of work in trade secret and covenant not to compete cases, and that's always a hot topic for trying to prove someone took something or a competitor's possession of the information. and had some very early experiences with some of the pioneers in electronic discovery work. Was fascinated with the subject and got involved in it. My first CLE, I did some work recently to dig through old presentations, and I found the first seminar that I did on electronic discovery was in 1998. And I still remember describing to the audience all of the sources of information that they should consider looking at in discovery. And I remember the eye rolls and the exasperated looks I got when I started talking about cell phones and the early PDAs and some of the rest of it. And, you know, unfortunately, some lawyers still give you that exasperated look in the eye roll when you talk about some of those sources. But that's how I got started.
I remember doing a CLE in Indianapolis in, I think, 2005 and getting those eye rolls. But anyway, Adam, how about yourself?
Well, I started at Weil Gotshal in 1996 and immediately got put on a big case that had to do with computer networks. And I had no technical background before that. I was a philosophy major in college. Didn't think I had the aptitude for computers, but I got fascinated with the whole project of translating the technical information to lay people, essentially, judges, lawyers, etc., and really got into it and ended up cross-examining the technical witnesses. At that time, I don't think there was a name for this. I don't know. I don't believe people were using the phrase electronic discovery. I kept up my interest in computers. The internet was just starting to boom at that time. I got very interested in internet-related legal issues and did a lot of work in the digital music copyright space. And then in just after 2000, I guess it was about 01 or 02, the head of our litigation department asked me and my then partner David Lender to write a primer for the litigators at the firm on e-discovery, since it was becoming an important topic. That eventually found its way into the hands of a business developer at Aspen Publishers, who asked us to write a book, which was Electronic Discovery Law in Practice. And 2 weeks before the book was published, the manuscript was cited in the Zubilek opinion. Ended up getting cited in three of those opinions, and from that point on, my life really became dominated by electronic discovery. And I eventually got so interested in the technology aspect of it that I left practicing law in 2006 to come to FTI.
Well, let's jump right into this area, Adam. I think everyone knows not all search tools are the same, although they all have sort of search bars and things like that. What are some of the critical differences between different search tools?
Well, there are a lot of differences, and some of these differences really are rooted in the purpose for which the search tools were created. And I think as we continue the discussion, we'll see that some of the problems with using different search tools in litigation has to do with the fact that they weren't necessarily created for that purpose. But with search tools, you have so many different methods, theories upon which the tools are based. So, you know, you have the simple Boolean keyword searches, you have Bayesian, you have concept searching, clustering. There are many different ways that the search tools are conceived and designed. And in addition, what's very important to attorneys reviewing information is how the information and the results are then presented to the people that need to look at the results. And there are some very interesting ways to do that, and a lot of big differences among the different search tools that can have a real impact on especially the efficiency and the speed of the review. And then there are all sorts of subtle differences which can be real landmines in terms of how the search tools treat or operate on different types of electronic information. And I think we'll see through our discussion that understanding very specifically the limitations, because every search tool has some limitations, understanding those limitations and being able to document what the search tool actually did and being able to explain it, it's going to be a very important point.
Well, to go a little bit deeper into some of the studies, you've done some studies on this about replicating searches across different search tools. you know, can you give a little glimpse of what you found?
Yeah, and it's a little bit unnerving. You know, people who are not familiar with this area really get nervous when they start hearing about this. You know, I would analogize it. It doesn't work the same way, but when you go on the internet and you do searches using Google or Yahoo or some other search engine, the results don't look the same. You don't get the same results. And what when you delve into how the search tools that we're talking about here operate, you start to learn that because of the way they work, they won't necessarily come up with the same results, even if you are doing a simple keyword search on the same set of data. So, you know, once you see that, and you see that there's no uniformity among the results, that really gives you an appreciation for how important it is to understand the implications of the search tool that you're using.
Michael, you've even noticed this same result within a single eDiscovery review platform. We talked before we did came up with the concept of doing this, and you gave me an example of running the same search using two different search options within which both search the same corpus of material. Would you care to explain this to the audience without scaring them all to death?
Yeah, there are any number of search tools and indexes that are out there, and Adam mentioned obviously for the internet, Google, and you know there are a number of others. But in the e-discovery space, there are companies that have come up with their own engines, and there are also some pretty common ones. DT Search is one that a lot of vendors have incorporated into their products, and you know the tool that we use at Littler has two different options. You can search using kind of a default search engine in the tool, which leverages the built-in full-text indexing capabilities of the SQL database, and it also has DT Search as an option. And when we first got the second option, I started playing a little bit and searching for the same term using both the DT Search index and the SQL index, and was surprised at getting the different results, and started doing some digging to figure out what the source of those differences are. And it comes down to a handful of things, and Adam can probably expand on this a bit, but there are stop words that different search indexes use. And we all have encountered this as lawyers if we used Westlaw or Lexis. I remember the first time someone was training me on using Westlaw decades ago, and they described that, you know, you need to select the search terms that you use with care, and you don't want to search for words like a and the, is, be, commonly used words that seldom have any relevance or meaning when you're searching for content. And so they don't index them. And the eDiscovery search tools are no different. And so different search engines use different stop words or noise words that they don't index. And in different tools, you can configure those stop words from case to case, or even from one index to another, searching within one case. And so if the words you're searching for end up on a stop word list, you're going to get rather odd results, because not only are the stop words sometimes different, but the treatment of those stop words in the results of the search can be different.
Yeah, you'd even mention in the employment area where you focus on that sometimes there'll be a keyword that's on that stop list. And
yeah, you know, in a lot of cases where someone is disputing that they were paid for all the time that they worked, search terms like clock in, clock out, punch in, punch out, overtime are commonly used. And if you look at a lot of the search engine stop words, in, out, and over are stop words. So that's something that we're usually very careful to check to make sure that the index we're using is not going to be skipping those words when it generates the index. The other big thing is spaces. What characters are treated as a space? The period, the slash, the dollar sign, parentheticals can sometimes be ignored and treated as a space. So the example that I always use to demonstrate this to people, I'll do a search for the word apple in one index and then in another, and get oftentimes different search results. And then I'll search for apple.com and get different search results. And what is happening is, in one instance, Apple is treated as an individual word because the search engine has treated the period, the dot between Apple and .com, as a space. So it recognizes the word Apple as a freestanding word instead of as a part of Apple.com. The other index does it differently. And so you can get, with just that one little simple example, you can get different results from the different search engines. So it really comes down to what Adam said earlier, which is understanding the strengths and limitations of the tool that you're using, knowing how you can configure it to your needs in a given case, and whether it's even configurable, and making sure that you've documented that so that if push ever comes to shove, you can explain to somebody how you got the results that you got. And if you've made a mistake, be transparent about it, explain it, and work to rectify it.
Boy, for all the lawyers that grew up on Lexis and Westlaw, I think we're scaring them to death, Adam. Do you think most lawyers understand how to use the search tools they currently have?
Well, I think they may understand how to use them, but they don't understand how they work and what the limitations of those search tools are. Michael talked about differences between search tools and different results that you get, and we've done testing where the same search tool has returned different results on the same set of data. So I don't think most lawyers would be comfortable with that. And I think that, you know, many lawyers, I hesitate to say most, but many lawyers still have the attitude that this is not a subject matter that they need to know anything about. But of course, what's happening now is as greater awareness of the differences between the tools and the results that they provide and the accuracy of the different tools is growing as a result of some of these judicial opinions, opposing lawyers are starting to ask about it. They want to know why they didn't, why they got certain documents and not others. They may do this based on inconsistencies in a production or for other reasons. And, you know, I think it's clear that this is going to become a more common routine topic at the Rule 26F meet and confer. So I think most lawyers do not understand the limitations of what they're using. And you have to keep in mind that search is something that is really permeating the entire litigation process. So if you think about the electronic discovery reference model and the steps in the process, there's really a search being done almost at every step. So when you need to identify which documents you're going to preserve, how are you going to do that? You need to collect documents. How are you going to do that? And very often, in fact, in most cases, there are going to be different tools used to accomplish that at different steps in the process. Very often, the lawyers, or we're talking about the outside lawyers here, are getting presented with a corpus of information that is already the result of some search that's been run internally at the client, maybe using an enterprise search engine or maybe using some other method. But this is something that I think the lawyer's way of looking at this needs to be, can I explain this? Is it possible for me to defend what we've done? And it's hard to do that without having an understanding of it.
Well, I mean, you can look at this two different ways, I guess. And I'll ask you this, Michael, although Adam, if you have an opinion, it's either the lawyer and the law firm's responsibility to become more proficient in search or have experts engaged that will help support you. Do you have suggestions, Michael, since you're at a firm, on becoming more proficient in search, as well as, you know, the need maybe sometimes for some people to bring in outside experts?
You know, I don't think there's any right answer to that question. There are lawyers like me who are intrigued by how things work. I don't shy away from the detail and the challenge of figuring it out and mastering it. It's kind of fun. There are others for whom that is tedium, boredom, beyond something that they want to get good at. And so I think different lawyers are going to try different paths to get good at it, and some are going to figure it out for themselves, and others are going to leverage experts or others in their firm. And in fact, in some of the case law on that you mentioned earlier, there's a debate whether or not lawyers are even qualified without experts to engage in this. I don't think that you need an expert in every situation, but some specialized knowledge and expertise in how those things work is very important. There are times when you don't know what questions to ask unless you've been guided through it. You know, Adam mentioned using enterprise search tools, or another common one that we see is our email archives. And a lot of times in-house lawyers will think, you know, we've got this email archive, we can search through it, we don't need your help, I'll have the IT guys do it. But we sit down and walk through the tool with them and make sure we understand what the limitations are. And oftentimes we'll find that there are some arbitrary limits built into the tools. They have a cap on the number of search results that they'll turn, that they will return in response to a search. So while there may be 10,000 hits, the thing is programmed only to kick back 1,000 results. Or other times they may not search the entire data set. So really knowing how those things work is very important. And if the lawyer can't figure that out on their own, I think they do need to reach out for help.
And Adam, your opinion on this, because I know I've had a few phone calls from even some large firms asking where do I find experts in this in case we get questioned. You know, would you be on the short list, and where do we find others?
I mean, the answer to the question is yes, in that lawyers do need to know more about search. They don't need to become experts, but they need to know enough to fulfill their professional responsibilities to be representing their client competently. And they also need to use experts, because there is no way to know enough about this area unless you have the time to keep up with it. It's changing so rapidly. I was talking to Michael yesterday about how astounding it is, just the proliferation of technology products in this area, and just the task of just keeping up with what's new and the changes that are going on in even the major products is quite a daunting task. And I don't think, you know, there are litigators that have the time to do that as sort of a hobby. If they do, they're probably, you know, polishing off their resumes. In terms of learning what they need to know, there are some very helpful resources out there. And in particular, there are the publications by the Sedona Conference, which are intended for lawyers in the legal community, and really do a great job of providing an overview and a sort of simple explanation in terms that lawyers can understand of the whole search and retrieval issue.
Michael, in the recent Sedona Conference publication, Achieving Quality, there were a number of steps suggested to improve quality in searching for ESI. Things like having team leaders to project manage, doing iterative searches, using different tools, statistical modeling, and many others. Many of these have very little to do with the search engine used. Do you think the search tool is critical, or is the process developed more critical?
You know, I think that the search tool can definitely make a difference in the kinds of searches that you can run and what you can do with the results. But more important is, you know, the theme that's emerging from the conversation here, and that is really understanding the strengths and the limitations of the tool that you're using. Because it's not just the ability to run the search, but it's how are the results spit back out at you. And how can you use those results to manage the review that comes next? Just getting the search term results is the first step, but looking at the search term hits by custodian, looking at them by date range, looking at them by different document type, and finding creative ways to cull the result set down so that everybody is focused on the right set of documents is really what I think that process that's outlined in the Sedona publication is all about, and search is just one part of that.
You know, one of the things I'm thinking about right now, and Michael, you're talking about different ways of playing with the with your tool and date range and custodians, and I'll direct this to you, Adam. Are you doing these testing this sort of running your tool through different scenarios on data pre-litigation so that you understand your tool, or are you actually doing this on each individual case trying to understand, you know, how your tool is working within the case?
Well, we do both. I mean, we do testing independent of cases. And of course, when we're confronted with something new on a case, we'll do testing then, because even if you're familiar with the tool and you've done testing on the tool, you know, working with it in a particular environment or for a particular purpose may involve some nuances. I find that so many clients now, corporate clients, are interested in incorporating sophisticated search tools in-house so that they can, you know, more precisely zero in on the data that they need to throw over the wall to a vendor or a law firm and reduce their costs. It's just they're all interested in that. So it's important for people in the industry like me and you to have knowledge, authoritative knowledge about these products so that we can advise clients on them, because, you know, this is certainly a key area where clients think that they can reduce costs. And sometimes, you know, this point about the tool versus the process is a very important point to get across to clients, because what they're looking for is the easy button. And, of course, that doesn't exist here. And, you know, when they come to you asking, well, why can't we just, you know, put in this enterprise search product, you need to be able to explain what the ups and downs of it are.
Yeah, and we had Judge Facciola on a Privilege Log podcast 2 weeks ago, and he made the point that he quoted one of his friends and said, perfect is the enemy of good. You know, we need to understand what we're doing, not, this is impossible almost to be perfect in because of the volumes. But Michael, now going into some sort of deeper areas within the search tools themselves, do search tools search all forms of ESI?
You know, the answer varies depending upon the tool and how you've got it deployed. The perfect example of this that I like to use with clients oftentimes will say, well, you know, Outlook's got a search feature. Why can't I just use that to search my email? Or they reference, another type of search tool. And unfortunately, you know, Outlook, and it gets pretty complicated pretty quickly, but depending upon the version of Outlook you're using, depending upon the version of Exchange that Outlook is linked to, an Outlook search probably won't search the attachments to the emails. So perfect example of, it's got a search feature, it's a search engine, but it's not indexing all the different forms of content that one should be searching. And almost all of the more sophisticated tools out there have the ability not only to generate an index, but to be specific about what gets indexed. Sometimes you index just the body of a message and some of the to, from, CC, BCC subject line metadata fields. Other times you might want to index a lot of other metadata properties or other attributes of ESI. And knowing what that tool can do and can't do and the differences you're going to get when you run the searches is very important.
Yeah, I think that's really one of the key misconceptions that clients looking for the easy button have, that if you read the marketing from the vendors, you would definitely come away with the impression that this product is going to enable you to search everything. That's what they advertise. But, of course, there's a lot more than just, it's not just Google for your enterprise, which is what everybody wants, where tools are able to search multiple different sources. There's a whole lot of linking and configuration that's involved in enabling them to do that, and they're never going to be able to check every source. Just like you know, somebody has a paper in a drawer at home, you know, they keep electronic information stored in places that are not reachable by a centralized search tool.
Okay, and yeah, I remember back in Enron, there was one of the leading tools that was on the market, still is on the market, not a bad tool at all, but it hadn't been updated for a certain Microsoft Outlook version and missed all sorts of you know, if it was a certain year of Outlook, it wasn't going to see it. So there is a complexity within this area.
And another issue we haven't talked about yet, but it's not only is the engine capable of creating the index, was it pointed at the right stuff to index, and when was the last time the index was refreshed? Different tools, you know, automatically index the content of new materials that are added to them. Others need to be, you know, you need to kick off a new indexing process to make sure that the index is updated. You know, that's not a very complicated concept, but it's something that's pretty easy to forget.
You know, you've mentioned index a few times, and for the listeners that maybe you know, are getting stuck on that term, you know, what do you mean when you're talking about the index? How would you define that for?
Well, when a search engine analyzes the content of the material that it's indexing, and this varies from tool to tool, but it creates an index, a listing of all of the words that were found, the documents that they were found in, sometimes the order of the words. Some engines have, in addition to just simple Boolean, you know, term A and term B, or term A or term B. Some also do proximity, term A near term B. And so depending upon how the tool is configured, it will create different kinds of indexes. But basically, it's just a listing of all of the terms that were found in the documents that it was pointed at to create an index of. And so when you actually run the search, you're not searching the actual content of the documents. You're searching the index that was created from a review of those documents.
Okay.
Adam, feel free to expand on that if you think you can.
Well, I think that's a good explanation. And you know what I think people don't realize is that indexing is not a uniform process, and all of these tools do it differently, and that explains to some degree divergent results.
Okay. Well, let's go into some micro level questions within the process of searching. Michael, you know, as a litigator, where do you begin the development of search terms?
Well, when I get brought into a case, you know, I start with the complaint, the discovery requests, talk with the trial team because they're the ones that know what the case is about. And then one thing that usually gets overlooked pretty easily, talking to the people whose data got collected and indexed. Different cases, you know, you're searching for different things. But generally speaking, you know, your search is only going to be as good as the search terms that you use. And unless you know how the people whose content you're searching used different words, your searches are not going to be very good or might have some gaps in them. So talk to the people whose materials you indexed. How did they refer to the parties in the litigation? Were there nicknames? What were the names of the projects or the products or other things that were used? Because that can greatly improve the quality of the search process. And finally, talk to opposing counsel. Generally speaking, you know, the case law would indicate that if you use search as a way to satisfy your discovery obligations, you should consider that as a part of the collaborative process of discovery and talk with your adversary about the search terms they want used. That doesn't mean you run every term that they want, but you take into account what they're looking for as well. And oftentimes, and this is a little off the question that you asked, but we'll oftentimes agree to run many searches, search terms that our adversary wants. And before we review those results, we take a look at the tallies. How many hits did we get for each one of the terms? And what's the ability of those different search terms to truly discriminate and limit the number of results? And then what's the quality of those results? And can we work together to find a way to narrow or broaden the searches to achieve a higher true positive result and get rid of false positives?
So you integrate some analytics into what you're doing.
Yes.
Okay. Adam, you know, early on people talked a lot about deduplicating, especially if you were involved in reviews and you saw the same document over and over again. You know, here we are in 2009. How important is deduplicating documents?
Well, it's still critical. And, you know, deduplication is one of these electronic discovery words that people use to mean different things. So it's important to be very specific about what is being deduplicated. Just for example, whether you're deduplicating documents within a custodian's collection or across all the custodian's collection, and the manner in which this is being done, which is not necessarily a simple task. It's very technology intensive, and I've seen major fiascos happen on cases where it wasn't done properly. But it's still important, even though a lot of the corporate enterprise content management systems now perform some level of deduplication as a way to decrease the storage burden for the company. So if there's the sort of straight deduplication that is going to identify documents that really are identical, and then there are other forms of deduplication, such as near deduplication. You know, so for example, if you had the same document in a Microsoft Word and another version of it in a PDF file, that would not be considered a perfect duplicate. Those are different types of files. But with a near duplicate search, you might be able to group those together so that you could see that they're duplicates and apply some consistency. It's particularly important when you're talking about the search and retrieval process, because Michael was describing this kind of iterative process where you're taking a look at the results of the initial search and seeing what you need to tweak, and especially you're paying attention to things like the tallies, the numbers of the results for different terms. Obviously, if there are duplicates in the population, you need to know that, because that is going to impact those numbers, and it's going to have implications for what you need to do to modify the search.
Michael, do you dump data into your search tool just right off the bat, or does it make sense to replicate a custodian's, say, their Outlook folders when searching?
When I have the opportunity to maintain the custodian's organizational structure for the content, I like to do that, because it helps you evaluate the results that you're getting from the engine. It can also help to later narrow the search results. I mean, if a custodian is very organized and they've grouped their documents by project, by subject matter, by person, or other things, it's a much faster way to get a good sense for what the document set looks like, what search terms that you might use. Nowadays, there are some new ways to conduct search with concept search engines and others, and one of the strategies you can use with some of those engines is to find documents that are representative of what you're looking for. So if the custodian has a folder about a project and that project or a person, and that project or person is central to the litigation, start your search or your review in those areas, kind of target-rich areas. Identify documents that are truly representative of what you're looking for, and then ask the concept-based search engine to go find other documents in the population that look like these documents. And if you've disregarded the organizational structure of the custodian, you lose out on the ability to do that kind of an analysis of the data set before you really get into the thick of the review.
Yeah, actually, Michael, you threw in a great question there that I hadn't thought about asking, but Adam, this area of concept searching, okay, we're talking a lot about search terms and things like that, but But there are a lot of very good concept tools out there, either linguistic loaded or based on algorithms. Does that open up the whole world of, you know, what we're talking about now in terms of search terms? You know, is this obsolete, our podcast?
No, I think the it's another brick in the wall in terms of helping the process be more accurate. So you wouldn't want to rely on, you know, just one pass with one method. And I think a lot of the value of the concept search tools would be to find documents that weren't hit by the keyword search so that you can then tweak the keyword search. You learn something about documents that are relevant but that don't contain your original list of keywords. Now, that can be very helpful when you're negotiating a list of keywords with the other side. The idea of concept searching, again, this is another word in e-discovery where it means different things to different people. And as you pointed out, there's no uniform method of doing concept search. The tools are all built on different theories and designed differently. One of the issues to keep in mind, if you're using a tool like that and it's going to be used to determine which documents get produced, is this whole idea of the black box versus transparency. And it can be very, very challenging to explain an algorithm or some kind of linguistic-based theory on which the concept search tool is based. So I guess the bottom line is they're not going to replace keyword searching, but they're significantly bolstering the accuracy of the process in general by being used in conjunction with keyword searching.
And very comforting to throw in the Pink Floyd reference too, so another brick in the wall. Anyway, Adam, how do you find misspelled words, variants, synonyms? Because those are filled in the corpus of documents you're searching.
Right. Well, there are a number of different approaches to this. One of them would be using concept searching. Hopefully that's going to, really, depending on what the algorithm is or the linguistic basis of it, it'll find documents that are similar to maybe documents that you fed it, seeding it with relevant documents. And that's sort of a very advanced way to do it. But there have been ways to do this, and lawyers who use Lexis or Westlaw know about this stuff, going way back. And you have fuzzy searches, which incorporate the ability to find similar words. Okay, they may have not the same order of letters. They may have different endings or, beginnings, but the tool can have, a sort of a reference library of what to look for, looking for other words that are similar to the one that you typed in. And then, of course, there's the use of wildcards to do the same kind of thing. So, including a character in the search that could be anything. And as far as synonyms go, most of these tools now, they have a thesaurus function built in so that the search, the search will also find the synonyms of the words in your keyword search that are in the tool's thesaurus. And you can just see the layers of complexity here. If you are a lawyer looking to attack someone's search, boy, there's certainly a rich body of material to shoot at.
Okay, well, let's talk about a problem we talked about before we came up with the podcast here, the problem of time zones when documents are imported into a search engine. What time zone do you apply your document as a default? How does that look in court or depositions?
Well, by default, when we process information for a case, we default everything to GMT, Greenwich Mean Time. The way most systems handle time, they don't actually store the local time of a document, an email, for example, and I'm going to limit it to Outlook here, but most of them are pretty standard. The when you send a message or you read a message or you create a message, the time that is stored in the system is something called UTC, which is basically Greenwich Mean Time. And then your local machine has a time zone offset based upon the time zone that was set on your computer. So when you view an email message on your computer, it's translating the GMT to your local time zone, and it's also taking into account your daylight savings time settings as well. But when you process email for review in an electronic discovery tool, decisions need to be made about what time zone you're going to use. Are you going to use the local time of the server that's doing the processing? Are you going to use the local time for the machine it was collected from? Do you know the local time of the machine that the information was collected from? Sometimes you don't. And so by default, we process everything in GMT, and that has some advantages but some disadvantages. The advantage is if you want to do a date sort of all of the emails in a responsive to a search, if you've processed everything in one time zone, you know, you're going to get everything ordered by date exactly the same across multiple custodians. If you've processed everything with, you know, Fred in Central and Julie in Pacific, you're going to have some fun reviewing those and keeping track of which message came first. But it does pose some challenges for litigators when, you know, if you imagine trying to print exhibits for use at a deposition, the email message may show that it was sent at, you know, 9 p.m. Well, actually, it was California, so that's GMT minus 9, and so it was actually, you know, middle of the day. And so you've really got to understand those processing steps and work with the trial team that's going to be doing the review and the use of those documents to make sure that they understand the time issues. Fortunately, some of the newer tools are now giving you the ability to do some local time zone offsets for batches of records or specific custodians. And I think over time it's going to be a little bit easier to deal with this. But right now it's a fun little gotcha item.
Mm-hmm. For both of you, we've talked a little bit about quality control steps when testing the results of your searches. How do you suggest doing a quality control test to test the results of your searches and also what you discarded?
Yeah, well, I think the key way of doing quality control on your results is the sampling approach. Because we're talking about gigantic volumes of documents typically, and there are two problems. The problems are missing things that are relevant that weren't hit by the search, and there's also the problem of hitting a lot of things that aren't relevant. So I think that, you know, there's a lot of discussion about sampling. There's a very nice appendix to the Sedona Commentary on Quality, Sampling 101 for the e-discovery lawyer. But, you know, there are many different ways to do sampling and statistical sampling, judgmental sampling, all kinds of different ways. But really what it boils down to is looking at some of the documents with a human eye to understand why a relevant document wasn't found, and then adjusting the keywords accordingly and you know, vice versa for the over-inclusive part. In important cases, and where you have to defend your methodology, you may want to have a statistician who can testify about the confidence levels and the error rates, etc. But I would say, you know, my key quality control step would involve sampling.
Okay. And you know, Michael, we'll start with you. You know, looking at search for next year, 2010, rest of this year, where do you think we're going with search?
You know, I think, I don't know that the short term looks that much different, with the exception of hopefully lawyers having a better understanding of it and recognizing that it is a something that should be approached on an iterative basis. you know, we usually have pretty good luck working with opposing counsel to explain this process and work through it. The problem is it takes a lot of time. And so if you haven't had a conversation about how you're going to run this process at the Rule 26 and had the scheduling order reflect the amount of time it takes to do this, you're going to come up on some time crunches and some deadlines. And so I think as more people talk about it, as more people do seminars and write articles on the topics we're talking about today, I think you're going to see a greater interest in this and a greater adoption or recognition of these processes and issues. A little bit further out, I think we're going to see more and more reliance on some of the new stuff like the concept searching, clustering, categorization. Right now, we're using that as a kind of a QA step. You know, once we find documents that are relevant to the case, let's go find other documents that are like these that weren't in the results set. Once you find a set of privileged documents, let's go find other documents like these documents that look like a privileged document, but they weren't marked as privileged, and using them in that way. You know, maybe someday we'll get to the point where we'll start using some of those as the basis for discovery responses, but I think we've got a long way to go before people feel comfortable using those newer cutting-edge tools for that purpose.
Okay. And do you have any thoughts on that as well, Adam? Or
I do think that I agree with Michael that I think these search issues are going to become fundamental issues in the discovery process that get discussed at those planning conferences. And beyond that, though, I guess I have a little bit more of a feeling that people are going to be relying more and more on statistical justifications for their search methodologies. And, you know, just because the volume of information just continues to increase, the ability to control the costs in e-discovery depends completely on limiting the volume. And I think that what the signals that we're getting from the courts, or at least the forward-thinking judges here, you know, are that there's a certain degree of inaccuracy in, you know, not finding relevant documents that we're all just going to have to accept because we've been lying to ourselves thinking that the human review is of every document is a perfect system. You know, we're missing a lot of documents there too. So I think that cultural shift is going to happen. And, you know, once we have a few cases which, you know, accept a certain search methodology or combination of methods and process, that this will become more standardized and people will start to use a process and hopefully, you know, some standards in terms of technology that was already accepted by the courts. You know, I think that we can't underestimate the difficulty of the cultural shift that we're talking about. If I'm a plaintiff's lawyer, certainly, you know, hearing that I just have to accept the fact that the smoking gun email that wins the case for me may be in the 1% of documents that, you know, we know we're not getting. I mean, that's just, it's going to take a real battle to get me to accept that. And I think, you know, we're not there yet. Most people have no idea, even with all the publications, of the work that's been done that has shown how inaccurate various search methods are and why these things need to change.
Yeah, we've done some nice podcasts here with Jason Barron and some of the initiatives he's involved in. There's a lot of information, if you just look for it, that really opens your eyes, especially on human review. But I think this podcast done a good job also explaining some of the variations on technology review. Hey, I apologize. I had one more question I want to ask that just kept sticking in my gut as we were talking at the top of the show about the differences in search engines and the differences in tools. You know, as someone that's out there talking to people and proposing using a particular search engine, the question I always get is, well, how much per gigabyte does it cost? And very, very seldom do you get any questions about search methodology or how does the tool work? And, you know, do you have any advice for people evaluating search tools, how you actually look at this stuff?
Well, you mean in terms of how it works?
Yeah.
Understanding how it works. I find that people are starting to ask more and more that question. But you're right, it's still fairly rare. And look, you have to be able to, we talked about the fact that there has to be transparency if you're going to defend what you did.
Mm.
And, you know, you're going to have to be able to explain it. Now, that's a very uncomfortable position for a lot of vendors because at some level, the information is probably proprietary, confidential, you know, intellectual property. But that's a hurdle we're going to have to get over if we want to defend what we're doing.
Yeah, and I think when I encounter that, I try and remind people that, you know, I think the last number I saw was that about 70% of the e-discovery crossed is still eyeballs on documents. And so, you know, I would rather spend a little extra with better tools to be able to conduct the analysis and cull down the document set so that we get as few documents as possible that need human review. So cost is one factor, but the capabilities of the tool and how you can leverage it are far more important.
And these are also, you know, trends and you know, discussions that are really now just starting to happen. And you know, hopefully this podcast helps. And Adam, just to sort of conclude it, I think that you raised a good point. And you know, Judge Paciola mentioned in the previous podcast, we got to get it down to a level a 12-year-old can understand it. Because if it's not at that level, then it's not transparent. So, but I want to thank both of you guys for participating in this. I think it's been a really interesting show, and I'd like to thank anyone that downloads this for thank you for joining us. And for a complete list of shows, visit www.esibytes.com. And remember to visit ESI Bytes to learn tips about electronic discovery and records management before ESI bites you back. This is again Carl Schinneman from Juranov. Have a nice day.